First Coast Connect with Melissa Ross is sponsored in part by Baptist Health.
Will the city of Atlantic Beach ban homeless people from sleeping in public? Good morning. We're live from Studio 2. I'm Melissa Ross, and this is First Coast Connect. Thanks for listening. Just ahead this morning, why some advocates say a new proposal at the beaches would criminalize homelessness. But let us know what you think. Give us a call. It's 549-2937. Then later, some important food safety tips for your Thanksgiving table. That and a lot more ahead coming up this hour. But first this morning, the city of Atlantic Beach may ban homeless people from sleeping in public. A new proposed ordinance would restrict where the homeless in the beach's community could sleep or camp out. Now, supporters of the measure first proposed by Atlantic Beach Police say it's being driven by safety concerns. But advocates for the unhoused say the bill would essentially criminalize homelessness. This is a concern for communities, not just in Atlantic Beach, and we want your thoughts. But first, let's welcome Dan Scanlon of WJCT News. He's been covering the story and joins us in studio. Good morning.
Good morning.
And also here to give her expert insights, Dawn Gilman, CEO of Changing Homelessness.
Good morning.
Good to have you both. And here's our question to callers. What's your reaction to a new proposal in Atlantic Beach? It would ban sleeping in public. We're talking about homeless issues on the show this morning, and we want your calls. Give us a call with your comments, questions. 549-2937 is the number. Emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. Tweets to @MelissaInJax. Facebook always open. Dan Scanlon, let's begin with you. You've been writing about this story at WJCTnews.org. It comes from the Atlantic Beach PD. What would it do, essentially?
Well, Chief Victor the Chief. Sorry, I can't pronounce his last name. I'm not going to massacre it. Basically came up with the idea. It was then drafted by the city attorney and reviewed by others. It is consistent with current case law and represents a best practice approach to protect all citizens in our city while recognizing the need to respect the constructional right of people to travel freely. That is from the staff report. This was, in fact, approved on first reading last night during the City Commission meeting. It'll show up again November 28th for a public hearing, second reading, and presumed approval vote. And what the chief stated to me is their current ordinance does have the fact that if you are violating provisions of it, you would be charged with a misdemeanor violation. That stays. But what they are doing in this is that you'll be warned of the violation and asked to voluntarily leave. A new provision requires the person must be notified of available emergency shelters and, quote, as the chief tells me, we would assist them with transportation to one of those. Of course, none of the beach's communities have a shelter. There is Mission House, which is currently handling 160 homeless people in their six-month program to assist them in finding shelter, assist them in finding some alternatives, and also does food and some showers and things like that. They're also meeting with Sulzbacher Center to understand how, quote, we can connect the homeless in our area with their Hope Team and Urban Rest Stop. We are also compiling a list of services from numerous providers in Jacksonville for those in need. So basically, They're now adding layers of offering assistance, and they even state that they would be willing to assist them with transportation to one of the downtown shelters. So There is multiple layers in here, the chief informs me. But the fact is, if you are sleeping someplace and they catch you and you don't leave, you get arrested. And as the Mission House executive director told me yesterday, she's afraid this will drive some homeless deeper into places like woods where there are camps built where cops may not necessarily go. And those are trouble spots in some parts of our community. There have been deaths, there have been injuries, there have been robberies because some people just don't play nice together.
The interim executive director of Mission House also told Dan she believes this measure would criminalize homelessness. Dawn Gilman, CEO of Changing Homelessness in Jacksonville, what's your reaction? You are the leading expert on these issues, I think it's fair to say, in this community.
So I think Atlantic Beach is going to run into two really big problems. This has been tested in federal law before. And to arrest someone for sleeping or not having, you have to give them a place to go to. There has to be an alternative. At this point, On many or most nights, all of our shelters in Duval County are full. So if you arrest someone and there is no other place for them to go to, and you aren't helping them get the 12 to 15 miles to the other place, I think they are opening themselves up for lawsuits. And it just emphasizes, again, one of our most recent by name lists, which is a list of everyone that we know by name in Duval, Clay, and Nassau County, there are 3,400 people experiencing homelessness. There are not 3,400 emergency shelter beds in the three-county area. We have about 1,100. Mm-hmm. So I get that people don't like to see other human beings being forced to live on the street, and arresting them does not solve that problem. We're just asking our police officers and sheriff's departments to become our next emergency shelter for homeless folks. Hmm. They, Duval County Sheriff's Office is already the largest provider of mental health services in the county. This is could potentially even exacerbate the problem more.
How much has the pandemic and inflation and the lack of affordable housing, which is a big problem at the beaches, contributing to all of this?
So the affordable housing crisis was a crisis a decade before COVID hit. When COVID hit, I think for the first time in a very long time, people started actually noticing homeless folks again. When there was a safer at home order, a lot of people started thinking, where do you go to be safe if you don't have a home? I think this ordinance is what is that swinging back to the way it used to be. These homeless ordinances are popping up all over the country at different levels of veracity against the people who are literally on the streets. So it is a real concern. We track for different programs, different populations. Once someone is homeless and they are connected to and enrolled in a housing program pre-COVID, in one that my agency happens to run specifically for veterans, it took us about 34 days from the day that they were enrolled to the day that they leased up and were moving into housing. That has moved up to 90 to 110 days. So even with all the same supports or even more supports, it's incredibly difficult to get into affordable housing, to find it, get the lease, and move in. In the beaches, it's just that much more difficult because it was challenging before home prices and rental prices started to increase in 2020, and it is even more so today.
We do have a statement from Atlantic Beach Mayor Ellen Glasser about this too. She says, this ordinance, if passed, provides that we will not cite people for being homeless without offering them information on a place to stay. It is not against the law to simply be homeless. That's the mayor. Let us know your thoughts as we talk about homeless issues on the show today. In Atlantic Beach, there's a proposal to ban sleeping in public, to actually arrest people for doing that, potentially. 549-2937, Tammy in Ocean Way. Hi, Tammy. Good morning.
Good morning. The point I wanted to make is that we need to identify and understand there are different categories of homelessness in each part of our town. We have pill heads, we have mental illness, and we have people who are down on their luck due to financial. In each section of Jacksonville, we need to take care of our homeless people and treat them for their cause. Downtown is more mental illness. Atlantic Beach is more drug-related, pillhead, meth head.
So how do you know that? How do you know that?
Because you walk the streets of Atlantic Beach that I go often, and you can see the individuals who are there. They're not the same people that are downtown Jacksonville. Anyone who lives in Jacksonville knows that. So these are the issues we need to focus on, not just lumping them all together as homeless people, because you're never going to fix it.
All right, Tammy. Dawn, do you agree with that?
So I'd like to remind everyone there are exactly six categories of homeless people: someone's mother, someone's father, someone's sister, someone's brother, someone's son, or someone's daughter. There are as many stories of how someone became homeless as people who are homeless. Sure, some people are abusing drugs and alcohol, as are persons who are housed. Some people have mental illness, as are people who are housed. some people just don't make enough money to have a house. So trying to divide it up geographically among our county doesn't work. There are homeless folks throughout Duval, Clay, and Nassau County. Yes, they are concentrated in different parts of each county. And when we do our point in time count every January, we find them even in the areas people don't usually think of. The executive director at Mission House mentioned, you know, as people move deeper into the woods, it's harder for them to get help and services. So that can happen also. But these are human beings who have issues. The main issue they face is they do not have enough money to pay for rent on a consistent basis.
And that's affecting a lot of Americans these days, for sure. WC in Arlington. WC, good morning.
Good morning.
Go ahead.
Yes, my comment, I see homeless people and I actually feel sorry for them. And I was just thinking when I see them, why can't we set up like homeless parks and give them tents and give them some type of security? It's a lot less than trying to find a building, but it would give them like a place to go until they are able to be put into some kind of a room or building.
Thanks for that. You know, we're getting emails about that. Here's one from Scott. I'm glad to hear Atlantic Beach will put a stop to homeless sleeping and putting up tents on the streets. We do not want what California is facing, he says. Dan Scanlon, you know, there was a tent city in downtown Jacksonville for a while, and the city actually cleared it out.
Yes, and there actually occasionally still is a large gathering, an encampment near the Clara White Mission many times. The person there just who called in talks about tent cities. New York City just erected a massive temporary facility to house homeless. Lots of pushback from residents who do not want this. That said, they're protected. They have services there, and I guess if that's an organized way to do it, it's an attempt to help them. Now, don't forget, what did Michelle Corum say this morning? We're going to face temperatures in the 40s or lower by the end of this week. That means our shelters will be doing emergency housing probably Thursday, Friday this week, and that means they will all be at their limit by midnight.
Lots of tweets coming into the show about this proposal in Atlantic Beach. Here's one. Find a solution for these people. Try to address the root cause. Have some empathy. Since rents exploded, it seems the homeless population has as well. This stuff doesn't happen in a vacuum. Don Gelman, you know, the city council, the Jacksonville City Council, is working on critical quality of life issues right now, is what they call it. And that includes this issue of homelessness. You are really plugged into this process. What's the latest on that?
I'm the co-chair of the homeless work group. So I have attended all of those meetings and all of the committee meetings as well. What we have discussed and talked about, especially in the homeless work group meeting, is there is a robust system of care for folks who are experiencing homelessness. And it's overwhelmed. There is not enough capacity to address every person who's experiencing homelessness. In an ideal situation, we would be able to identify and assist anyone within 30 days of a housing crisis. That does not happen. What we are looking for or asking City Council to consider is how do we get a recurring revenue stream to address this? Both the homeless crisis and the affordable housing crisis and access to health care. All of these three issues are incredibly intertwined. Many folks do become homeless for the first time after experiencing a medical crisis that knocks them out of work, and then they have an overwhelming number of bills and they just cannot keep up. When they cannot keep up, there's not another place for them to go to because we don't have enough affordable housing. And then a lot of our shelters have to make some really tough decisions. If folks are in a medical crisis, can they actually do all what we call the acts of daily living, which is required in a shelter because they don't have any kind of medical or professional nursing staff on there 24/7 to assist folks?
So is the city going to set up this revenue stream, I think is the question we have. My guess would be no, given past precedent.
I unfortunately am not a city council person, so I am not allowed to put anything forward. We did bring forward a couple different cities, communities that have done this. The first one is Miami. They have the Miami-Dade Homeless Trust. This is a state ordinance that allows them to do a 1% food and beverage tax on larger restaurants. They talked about that revenue stream and what that has meant in Miami. We talked to my counterparts in Atlanta, who did a $22 million bond issuance specifically to develop 200 units of permanent supportive housing that they got matched by philanthropy. Their public housing authority pledged some supports for it, as well as a mental health, to make that braid all those funding streams together. So other communities have shown the way that this is not something that is impossible to do, but it does take both the political will and the community will. If our local elected officials know that this is an important issue to solve, I would put forward there are many better ways to solve the issue than just writing another ordinance, which, quite frankly, are already on the books. It is illegal in Duval County to sleep, to eat, to cook, unless you are in a designated camping area. When you start looking about sanctioned encampments, I have yet to see it done well anywhere in the country. And like anything, it's got to go somewhere. And there will be pushback in whichever neighborhood.
Wherever you put it,
yeah, there will be pushback.
Dan.
You know, last week we had the eye care folks with the two sheriff's candidates. That brings back another issue that they've been pushing for, the civil citations. If you get a civil citation for a misdemeanor versus a nonviolent misdemeanor versus getting arrested, that hopefully can break the cycle of you're in jail, you lose your job, you can't pay your bills, and ultimately that may lead to homelessness. A civil citation allows you to continue working, which means X percent of people out there can continue being productive and feel better about themselves as they deal with the civil citation. So that's just another way to break the cycle that could be done by police departments.
Correct. And remember, every time we just walk by a homeless person or arrest a homeless person, there is a cost to the whole community. Anytime you arrest someone, it's $800 to $900 to get them booked. You have the time for the sheriff's officers, especially if they're beached, to transport. On average, for someone who is chronically homeless, it costs over $30,000 a year in medical, arrest, crisis stabilization units to allow them to continue existing on the streets. If we were to put that same amount of money into giving them permanent supportive housing, our highest level of assistance, that costs less than $20,000. So there's actually a net gain across multiple systems if we actually address
the issue. And you've made this argument repeatedly to our local officials for a long time, we need to point out. You're not new at this.
And don't forget, police departments at the beaches do not have jail facilities, so they have to transport these people to the Duval County Jail, adding to the cost for their department and to the cost at the jail. And
all great points.
Yes.
Susan in Fruit Cove. Go ahead, Susan.
Good morning. My experience with homeless and people who are living at life's edge is that nobody makes that choice. Nobody wants to be in those circumstances. And it doesn't happen overnight. There's a gradual obstacles that can't be passed. So I'm so grateful for the speaker to say that if our sister, our mother, our brother that's in those circumstances, so arresting them makes absolutely no sense at all.
Thank
and
you,
my,
Susan.
My comment is just please think of this as our humans. How are we treating human beings? Our society says you can just throw them away or just don't see them. But that's not who we really are. People in Jacksonville and St. John County really do care. And I just want everybody, if you could be very specific in who do we write and what do we say and how do we connect with getting that information, that would be very, very helpful.
Yeah. Thanks, Susan, for that. The answer is, if you care about this issue, let your local representatives know.
Yes, both at the local, state, and federal level. There's opportunities to advocate. If you are interested in advocating at changinghomelessness.org, we can get you on some of our email lists that keep you in the loop on when these issues do come up mm-hmm. and when it's important. Thank you.
Sure. Lisa in Jack's Beach. Hi, Lisa.
Hey, how are you?
All right, go ahead.
So I'm with Jack's Beach Brothers Keeper, and we work in conjunction with Mission House. We try to fill in the gaps. We have about 30 to 35 homeless that we feed on the weekends when Mission House is closed. And we also run, Jack's Beach Brother Keeper runs the cold night shelter with St. Paul's Episcopal. They're the only church that opens for cold nights out at the beach. Why don't any of the churches open for the homeless? We have all those tax-free buildings out there, all those churches. Why don't the elected officials get those churches to open for the homeless?
That's another great question, and I appreciate that information too, Lisa. All questions that people can bring before the Atlantic Beach City Commission, Dan, as they consider this measure later this month?
Yeah, second reading November 28th and the public hearing. In defense of what's in this ordinance that's being proposed, at least they are now putting layers of offering assistance, offering ways to transport, and working with Sulzbacher Center. So that offering is there. But the question is, as you have mentioned here, is how do you get them that 15 miles from a beaches community? Do you put them in a police car? That's money. Do you have a bus or a city vehicle that you use?
And is that the best use of police resources?
And it may not be, because crime is increasing in many places. And we certainly have had our share of major incidents at the beaches where all hands are necessary on deck to handle investigations. And they do a great job out there. I mean, but that said, I still have memories of the 80s and 1990s of seeing homeless sleeping at the edge of the boardwalk near the Red Cross lifeguard facility, half in the sand and tucked under the boardwalk for protection against the wind. It's a sight that I'll never forget.
Mm-hmm. Don Gilman, again, your website is changinghomelessness.org. Any other insight you can leave us with before we move forward?
We did not get here overnight, and we are not going to solve this problem overnight. I think the best thing this ordinance with the city of Atlantic Beach has done is made people talk about it realistically again and really think, if you're going to pass this, what happens when Sulzbacher's full? What happens when Sulzbacher, City Rescue Mission, Trinity Rescue Mission, and Salvation Army are full? What do you do then? Are you just going to transport them downtown and hope for the best? Is that solving the problem? Are you going to put in other things at the beaches to help solve this problem? One of my counterparts, as we're working through our COVID response, her best question, we'd get halfway there and she'd said, okay, what next? What do we do next when this happens? And I think that's the part we really have to think about. Just shuffling people around the county is not going to solve the problem, mm-hmm. but there are ways to solve it.
Don Gilman, CEO of Changing Homelessness, Dan Scanlon of WJCT News. Thank you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, much more still ahead later in the hour. How hurricanes tend to stir up more toxins in the river. Not good. We'll tell you about it. But up next.
I was so miserable that anything would be better than being a truck driver. So slowly, in the trucks, I taught myself to become an art critic.
From a truck driver to a renowned author, Jerry Saltz, on the defining art of the early 21st century. That's next. We'll be right back. And and a self-described failed artist, but Jerry Saltz went on to become a Pulitzer Prize-winning art critic and New York Times best-selling author, and he champions the work of marginalized artists. He's got more than a million followers on social media, too. Well, throughout the early years of the 21st century, Saltz has reported on a period he considers to be one of the most important in art history. It's all in a new volume tracing how the visionary artists of the early 21st have documented and challenged our culture. I talked with him about his new book, Art is Life, Icons and Iconoclasts, Visionaries and Vigilantes, and Flashes of Hope in the Night. Jerry Saltz, it's good to be with you, and thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Melissa. I hope everything is great down there in Florida.
We are hanging in there, you know, and I think your book, Art is Life, is a perfect holiday gift for anyone who values the role of artists to move the culture, to spark conversations. Tell us a little bit about what inspired this book.
Well, for listeners that don't know, I'm the senior art critic for New York Magazine. I have no degrees. I started as an artist in my 20s, and the same demons that you all listened to last night at 3:15 in the morning that said, you're no good, you don't know what you're doing, you've got bad ankles, you're a bad schmoozer. Well, I listened to those demons, Melissa, unlike you and other people. I self-exiled from being an artist, which I had loved being. I became a long-distance truck driver, believe it or not. I think the only Jewish one at the time.
Oh, wow.
And I drove from New York to Florida, New York to Texas once a month in these big trucks. I was delivering art, again, because I'm a Jew. I don't think I'm allowed to haul steel. In any event, when I was about in my late 30s, Melissa, I decided that I was so miserable and I loved art from afar so much that anything would be better than being a truck driver. So slowly, in the trucks, I taught myself to become an art critic. Now, has anybody ever tried to write, you'll know that writing is the worst thing on earth you can do. It's just the worst. Deadlines, however, are sent from heaven to us via hell. And so I scared up some jobs, started teaching myself to write, danced naked, and learned on the job in public, danced naked in public, that is, so to speak, metaphorically, and started to write. For me, art is incredible. It's the most advanced operating system our species has ever developed to explore consciousness, the seen, and the unseen world. That every picture tells a story, not only of its maker, but of the time, the place, the context, the biography, and it's all embedded in the material. So what this book is, long story short, is it's an accidental history of the art of the 21st century as seen by an art critic, loser art critic, who accidentally lashed himself to the ship of art over these last 22 years and wrote weekly and sometimes daily reports from the storm. And in this period came the greatest changes in art history that have ever taken place in art, and the book is a sort of, war report, if you will, from the front lines of the good, the bad, the very bad, the high, the low, the winners, the losers, the hangers-ons, the ones that burned out and didn't make it, and all of us in between.
Well, then, Jerry, what would be an example of how the art of this time period, the first two decades of the 21st century, has been so impactful?
Couple of ways. Let's look at the positive side first. That every work of art made in the 21st century, Melissa, from the contested 2000 election there in Florida, through the Iraq and Afghanistan Bush-Cheney wars, to the sense that the arc of history was bending towards justice, possibly under the first black president, to a kind of the return of the long American night in 2016, through the contested election of 2020 to yesterday, nothing has been made under vaguely normal conditions. And one of the things that happened during this, for good and bad, is the walls of our history came tumbling down. We saw the end of the ideology of modernism. Nobody any longer believed that art was linear. We suddenly understood it told a great story, but the story of how it was told isn't true. And more women artists, more underrepresented artists, artists of color, disabled. I'm an illegal Estonian immigrant myself. Estonians showed. And the point being that finally, for the first time in the history of art, Melissa, we were seeing far more than 50% of the story than had never been seen before. On the other side of the fence, more money than has ever rushed into the art world set upon us. And now we read about, like, obscene prices, mad auctions, the invention. If you saw a movie called The Last Leonardo, they recorded me. I happened to be the only art critic that looked at that Leonardo da Vinci, the Salvator Mundi. And again, I have no art degrees, Melissa. I went to Christie's and wrote this, that the painting isn't a Leonardo. It's quite handsome, I suppose, but it's certainly dead, and tracked the provenance of it. Of course, it was like a dreamed-up magic carpet ride by paying the most amount of money for the biggest name in art history to try to enter art history that way. And now this idiot art critic turns out to have been right, that it was bought for $400+ million. And like I said beforehand, it'll be fun to hang somewhere if they can ever hang it with that name on it. And they can't. That's why it's never been seen in public. But that was the period that we were in and we still are in. Long story short, in one of the most earnest, sincere moments in all of art, where all of these new people are making art and showing their own story, you have the cynical side of the equation that too many people see through, that we see it all, this money and elite and prices and just this thing that feels grotesque. So the book tries to take you through and make you understand that only 1% of 1% of 1% of all artists make any money. It's just that the press you're seeing, 99% of the press, is on that 1%.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
It's a fantastic story of accomplishment and vision by the artist.
But, you know, as you pointed out, you just love art, and people that are driven to make art typically aren't doing it for the money. They're just compelled to create beautiful works of art. And as your book shows, art lifts us all up. Art is vital to humanity.
Amen. I think it's part of a cosmic force, is what you're indicating without saying it, that's never not been with us. It may have no use, but we've never been able to get along without it. It may be using us to reproduce itself. Bob Dylan even talked about how it's like a ghost is writing the song and has picked him to write it. You know this on your show. I know it in my work, where I never know what I'm going to write until I write it. And I'm always somewhat surprised by what I wrote. Like, where did this come from? People listening to this, if you will get out of your own way and get out of the easy harbor of your fear loop, that goes, I'm no good, I have bad ankles, I don't know what I'm doing, I'm a fake. That's the easiest thing to say. We all say that at 3:15 in the morning. What I'm asking you to do is take what's uncertain, unfamiliar, and challenging, And that's how you map new things in your bad writing, your bad art, your bad radio, your bad movies, your bad literature. Take it from me, a bad writer. If you build it that way, they might come. Just get out of your own way. And if I may offer one piece of advice to the listeners, work, 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 you big babies. Just get to work. God.
Well, I love your advice. And, you know, I have the same 3:15 tremors in the middle of the night. I think we all do. But this is such a bracing and life-affirming message that is in your book, and I really recommend it. It's Art is Life by Pulitzer Prize winning art critic and New York Times bestselling author Jerry Saltz. A perfect gift for the art lover in your life. Jerry, it's so much fun to speak with you. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks, Melissa, and best to everyone in Florida. We're all thinking of you. We love you no matter what you do.
This Going Green segment is made possible by A1A Solar.
Well, ever since Hurricanes Ian and Nicole hit Florida, there have been several reports of algae blooms along the St. Johns River. None of the samples collected up to this point show evidence of toxins being present, but some results are still pending. It's also worth noting that toxins can show up at different stages of the algae life cycle. So, what do we need to know about all this? Well, we're pleased to welcome Dr. Jerry Pinto, research scientist at JU. He's here to fill us in on what's going on in the St. Johns River after the storms. It's today's Going Green. Good morning.
Good morning, Melissa.
It's good to have you. So what are you seeing in the St. Johns River since Hurricanes Ian and Nicole passed through?
Well, generally, when you have hurricanes come through like this, they dump a lot of fresh water, rain, and so we get a lot of runoff. So typically, a lot of this runoff contains nutrients that feed the algae. Mm-hmm. And so it's not uncommon to have algae blooms after these types of events.
Is this a normal amount of algae for this time of year or not?
I would say it's not unusual, partly because it seems to be that some of these algae blooms are persisting a little bit longer because the temperatures in the water have stayed more elevated. But generally speaking, we don't tend to see them this late. But it's sort of the new normal. We're going to start to see the hurricane season extend a little bit longer because of climate change, global warming.
Yeah, I mean, this was the first hurricane this late in the season to hit this way in 40 years.
Yeah, it was surprisingly late. Yeah.
But this is what we can expect now going forward.
I would say it's not too unusual to expect that.
So when it comes to the health of the river, how concerned should we be about these bigger and stronger storms coming later and later in the year, further degrading the quality of the water?
Well, there's not much we can do about it in the short term, but we can plan to reduce the effects that cause these things. And I'm talking particularly about carbon dioxide. In reducing our carbon footprint as a city and as individuals. The city can have more of an impact on that. JEA can have more of an impact on that. And we hope that that's the way forward to start to work towards that.
That's the obvious long-term solution. That's what's driving all of this. We need to decarbonize.
Yeah. I mean, a lot of our efforts these days are to try to put a Band-Aid on the immediate problems, but the underlying problem is carbon dioxide.
When it comes to the algae blooms, what's the danger to human and animal health? Getting back to that piece of the puzzle.
So increasingly, we are seeing algae is normal to have in the environment. And of course, when you have too many nutrients, you get too much algae, and then that can cause these environmental problems. Some of these algae produce toxins, and those toxins can attack your liver and your kidneys. or they can be nerve toxins. Mm-hmm. And so these cyanobacteria, which are the types of algae that we're seeing, depending on the nutrients and availability of those nutrients and the temperature and the amount of runoff, can produce these toxins.
Can you tell us a little bit more about your research at Jacksonville University to track what's going on?
Well, we have a couple of faculty that work in algae and defining what those algae are and also looking at the toxins they produce. So we have a lab that can do that. We also have folks that will go out and sample frequently to see how often we're getting these different types of algae.
Mm-hmm.
And there are a number of different ones, and not all of them produce toxins. But invariably, the DEP also has an algae bloom task force, and they also have labs that will analyze these samples. And they have a wonderful website that sort of shows you where these things are occurring. The only issue with that is it does take some time to get the samples back from the lab to tell us what the levels of toxins are. Most of the time when they're when algae is out there and you can see it, people can be alerted to it.
Mm-hmm.
One of the problems with these things is that once the toxins are produced in the water, sometimes the algae will dissipate and disappear, but the toxins will prevail.
Mm.
And for how long they prevail is another question. And of course, there's repeated testing to make sure of that, but that's always a concern. You can't see the toxin.
What we can see is the green monster, the algae blooms. What should people do if they spot one?
Avoid it.
Yeah.
You know, particularly people who are immunocompromised, young, old people, that kind of thing, because it can affect your ability to breathe properly, you know. So avoiding them and going in the water, stay away from them. Sometimes they have an aroma, smell associated with them, a musty smell, and you might feel sore throat or runny eyes. That's a classic sign that you should keep away.
Keep away. And listen to Dr. Pinto. He has some good advice for everyone concerned about this. We all need to get behind decarbonizing this planet to avoid the worst effects of climate change. That's something we regularly focus on this program. So Dr. Jerry Pinto, research scientist at Jacksonville University. Thank you for being here.
My pleasure.
And up next, food safety tips, for Thanksgiving and beyond. We'll be right back.
That was great.
Congaree & Penn Trees offers native trees grown on their 350-acre farm here in Jacksonville. Trees for private residences, commercial properties, and public areas. Reservations required to visit the farm. Information at 445-1459 or congareeandpenn.com. Lee & Kate's Glass. Family-owned and operated for 95 years. Lee & Kate's Glass is your source for upgrading your home's glass, from shower doors and mirrors to windows and tabletops. Learn more at leeandkatesglass.com.
Next time on The World, what happens after Russian troops withdraw from a Ukrainian city?
Our reporter takes us to a place that was liberated 2 months ago. Authorities have mostly restored electricity and water, but some areas remain off limits.
There could be mines here that the Russians planted before they left.
Our report from Izyum, northern Ukraine. It's on the World.
This afternoon at 3, here on WJCT News 89.9.
I'm Vipa Fernandez. The actor who plays Serena Joy in the hit series The Handmaid's Tale, Yvonne Strahovski, on the parallels between the show and real life.
It is very creepy and eerie how aligned we are with what's going on in the world. It is as if the writers have had some kind of a crystal ball.
That's next time on Here and Now.
Today at 2 on WJCT News 89.9.
Last week, voters got to do more than pick a party or candidate. Millions voted on a range of ballot measures, from old laws on slavery and new laws on psychedelics to rules about digital privacy and, of course, the right to an abortion. There were even ballot measures about ballot measures. Now that the dust has settled, how much has changed? We take a look next time on 1A.
Today, starting at 10 on WJCT News 89.9.
Welcome back. Well, whether you are planning a traditional holiday meal this Thanksgiving or maybe going for something more exotic, you need to keep safety in mind. That starts with shopping and it goes through preparing the feast and storing the leftovers. Keith Schneider is a UF IFAS professor of food science and human nutrition, and he's on the line with some safety tips for Thanksgiving and beyond. Hey, Keith. Good morning.
Good morning.
All right. This is really important. I have been a victim of Thanksgiving food poisoning. It happened 1 year at an extended family dinner some years ago. A bunch of us got sick. Not uncommon. So what makes holiday food safety different from everyday meals?
Well, typically we're cooking for more than the usual number of people. So that's the first thing that we're not used to. Instead of cooking for 3-4 people, we might be doing 2 or 3 times that many. So that's one thing. Next, we're typically cooking a meal that's larger than usual and more complex, and we have a larger opportunity to make mistakes. So holiday cooking, it's one of those things where it tends to be quite hectic, and we need to pay just a little bit extra attention to what we're doing.
That's great advice just to start off with. So what best practices do you recommend as we plan and shop for Thanksgiving?
Well, one of the first things, and probably one of the most problematic, is when we're dealing with the traditional holiday turkey. And not that everybody's going to be having turkey this holiday season, but that's the one that always causes the most problems. You have a larger than usual main course. It's a little bit difficult to handle. And quite honestly, it has the highest potential for containing pathogens. So just defrosting, typically what we purchase, a frozen turkey, can be problematic. People tend to want to leave it out on the counter or just leave it out and thaw at room temperature, and that's the first no-no. You want to plan ahead and spend a couple of days defrosting in your refrigerator. Turkeys or any meat product can purge, which means liquid can drip out of them. So typically when we defrost them in the refrigerator, you should put them in either in a separate bag or typically in a shallow pan. In this way, we can catch any of those drippings that may contain pathogens.
That's good advice. Yeah. And what are the other big mistakes that people make?
Once you get it out of the refrigerator, you're going to have to get it onto a roasting pan and into the oven. And that's another one of those areas where we can run into a lot of hassles. It is one of the most common things that we do. It's not really recommended, but most people do it anyway, is first of all, we have to take it out of the bag, which is, again, a chance for all that purge liquid to spread around the kitchen and, again, potentially put pathogens on your sink handles, in your sink, on cutting boards. The next thing we tend to try to do is to wash the turkey off, because, you know, we want to clean it up for some reason, because we're going to be, despite the fact that we're going to be cooking it, we want to make it look clean. And not that washing itself is terribly bad, but it's a very large food item. And when you put it in your sink, there's a tendency of the water just to kind of bounce off and spray to different parts of your kitchen, on the counter, if you have a two-sided sink, to the other side. And all this just increases the risk that we're going to be spreading pathogens to surfaces that are not going to be going to the oven. Again, sink handles and other items in your sink and cutting board. So washing your turkey, again, not recommended. Most people are going to do it. And if you do do it, remember to sanitize all the surfaces after you're done.
Yeah, just pat it dry, folks. You don't have to rinse it off. My grandmother taught me that, actually. Okay, any other danger foods to be aware of, like eggnog maybe, or anything else?
Absolutely. Anything that's potentially or can potentially contain pathogens. You mentioned eggnog, and that can contain raw eggs. Raw eggs, while rare, it can contain bacteria known as salmonella. And if you're going to make homemade eggnog, the general advice is to use a pasteurized egg product. That is definitely going to make it safer, or to cook the egg mixture, not till it curdles, but to heat it up to about 160 degrees. And that way, any potential pathogens in there are going to be inactivated.
Okay, last but not least, what about the leftovers? How do we make sure those don't go bad and make us sick?
Well, first thing, we need to make sure that we cook everything properly and everything's clean. And once we take it out of the oven and it's sitting around, we have a tendency to leave stuff on the counter while we're watching football games. But those leftovers should be put away within 2 hours. Because once they get into that danger zone, 40 to 140 degrees Fahrenheit, bacteria on the surface can begin to proliferate. So we want to put them away. And then store them for leftovers later that day or the next day. So 2 hours, put them in the refrigerator. Don't put things in the refrigerator that are too hot, because your refrigerator really isn't good with super hot foods. Try to wrap them in smaller containers. Don't overload or get excessively large containers, because they take a really long time to cool down in the refrigerator. And then once we have our leftovers in the refrigerator, you might want to put a date on those. Typically, things in the refrigerator are going to last 3 to 4 days. Freezer, maybe 3 to 4 months. But again, we want to make sure we use them up in a timely fashion.
All great advice. And Keith, I really appreciate it. I hope everybody was taking notes. I was. He's Keith Schneider, professor of food science and human nutrition with UF IFAS. Thank you so much, and happy early Thanksgiving, Keith.
Same to you. Thank you.
And thanks for listening, everyone. Thanks also to our team, David Luckin, Heather Schatz, Brendan Rivers, Isabella Da Silva, Michelle Quorum, and you. Drop me a line anytime at firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. I'm Melissa Ross. Make it a great day. We'll talk to you tomorrow.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.